Welcome to the Powers That Be Daily, Puck's podcast focused on the intersection of Wall Street, Washington, Silicon Valley, and Hollywood, and the players who run it all. I'm Peter Hamby. It's Wednesday, September 28th. Today, Dylan Byers is here to talk about Warner Brothers Discovery. Is the company's dismal stock price undercutting David Zaslav's promise to take the company to the promised land? And we talk about the NFL on Amazon. Is Bezos World happy with their Thursday night broadcast? And later on, Julia Alexander stops by to talk about how horror movies have become an unexpectedly powerful financial lifeline at the box office and for streamers in an era when Hollywood is struggling to figure out the big screen after the pandemic. We'll hear about all that and more on today's episode of Powers That Be. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. See how you profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/powersthatbe, netsuite.com/powersthatbe. That's netsuite.com/powersthatbe. Happy Wednesday, everybody. I'm joined today by Dylan Byers, who I like to talk to about all things media, whatever media means. I feel like I should start opening these episodes by apologizing to Dylan because John and I, for Media Monday, always steal Dylan's really good reporting for our own. So sorry, man.
No, it's okay. On the one hand, I feel, you know, it's like a huge compliment. And then on the other hand, there's a little bit of a like, well, I mean, fuck you too, you know?
Well, we always cite you by name, of course.
I know. I'm grateful.
I want to talk to you about Warner Brothers Discovery. The stock price continues to go down. And obviously, media companies are seeing a bunch of losses on Wall Street throughout this year as the market goes down. But, you know, he came in with this mandate to cut costs, right the ship, fix the stock price. You know, I hate to like ask these questions because people on Wall Street have such short attention spans and I complain about that a lot, but is he doing enough?
Look, I think it's a really big problem. And I do think the street is nearsighted in many ways. And I think the way that David and his leadership team think about it is here is a company that has been mismanaged in their view for a very long time, where a lot of sort of excess costs and excess positions were tolerated. And they feel like they're the first people to come in and really run it like a tight ship, and that necessitates a whole lot of really ugly cutting and a lot of destruction, and that the market is seeing all of these decisions, but not necessarily seeing the long-term benefit that I think David in his head thinks, okay, I know what this thing is going to look like 12 to 18 months down the road. I don't care if anyone else can't see that. The stock might be 11 today. 12 to 18 months from now, it'll be 30 or 40. Maybe part of that is predicated on you actually having the faith of the market. And I think that right now, everyone is sort of looking at this, and every time it goes down further, he is losing his juice. He is losing sort of his ability to sort of justify his ownership of the company. And I do think there's this question. We talk about it. Our colleague Bill Cohen talks about it. Is this really a holdover before they sell the company to somebody else? And I think that as complicated as it must be to run a media company, and if I knew how to run a media company, I would be a media executive, not a media reporter. But at the end of the day, like the formulation is pretty simple. You have to create hits, or cut costs. And creating hits requires an investment. You have to invest in things. And particularly in the creative industries, you have to invest in ways where you sort of have to take some risks. There's no science to that. It's more of an art. I think the problem here is he is having a hard time cutting enough costs to reassure the market that he is running this in a smart and sophisticated way. So he's got a lot more cutting that he has to do and a lot more pain that is going to ensue. And yet along the way, people are also saying, well, wait a second, if this company is going to be successful, then you also have to invest in creating hits and in making this a really competitive force, especially, you know, on the theatrical side, on the streaming side, all over the place. So my guess is that stock number probably pisses David Zaslav off every single day. And I think part of his frustration has to do with the fact that he still believes in himself and he still believes in his leadership team's ability to turn this thing around. And I think they feel like they just need a little more time. And increasingly, it looks like the street is not going to give them any more time.
Yeah, the street often sucks, though. I do want to say that, like, I mean, there are larger market forces at work.
There are.
And he's got to give people time to build the enterprise and their image. And then, you know, maybe after a year or so, you can sort of pressure test it.
That's right. And we should note all these push notifications I'm getting. These are not happening in a vacuum. Obviously, the entire market, you know, is down to, everyone's down, but WBD is just down so painfully far. And at a certain point, you get down that far and you start to ask questions about the long-term trajectory of the company itself.
Hey, I want to ask you about another streamer, actually, a streamer, but also a company that I just ordered tennis balls and poop bags from online, which is Amazon.
Do you have a dog? Because if you don't have a dog, that's a weird order.
It'd be super weird. No, Boone needs his poop bags. Amazon announced, I think after the Chiefs Chargers game two Thursdays ago, they had like 13 million viewers roughly. Mm-hmm. And they skewed actually a little younger, which I thought was interesting too. What's the gossip around Amazon, if you know any, about how this project is going? I mean, I'm excited for the Bengals-Dolphins game tomorrow night. My friend Kaylee Hartung is a sideline reporter. I like the broadcast. I'm excited for it. But what's the gossip around Amazon about how they're feeling about it?
They're feeling great about it. That 13 million, especially with the audience trending younger, like these are all extremely positive signs. One thing that struck me though, because I was talking to an Amazon source I know who had some insight into it, is that they feel really great about that this was a driver of a lot of additional subscriptions. But I think what surprised me about that is that, not unrelated to the sort of like myopia of the media itself, we tend to think about things through the prism of the sort of, you know, coastal city-dwelling people that we are. And I've always felt like, well, Amazon is such a dominant force in something like one out of every two households in this country. How much do they really need to spend all that money on the NFL? Like, aren't people who are going to have an Amazon Prime subscription, don't those folks already have an Amazon Prime subscription? The sense I got was, A, no, that this really helped in that effort. And this is the similar thesis behind why they're spending so much money on the Lord of the Rings prequel. The other thing I got is that in needing to compete for these additional subscribers, they don't have quite the competitive moat around them. They don't think that they have a huge competitive moat around them the way that I think I do. I sort of think that Amazon is invincible, because who else is going to get you anything you need in the span of 2 days, or in some cases 2 hours, while also providing you with this incredible streaming service that gives you access to all of the movies that you could ever want? And their feeling is actually like, once you get outside of LA, New York, San Francisco, Seattle, the Walmart factor is a much bigger threat than I think you don't understand if you're not really paying close attention. They actually feel like they, not only are they nowhere near done growing in this country, they also don't feel like they can rest on their laurels. I think they feel like Walmart still poses a threat. Other companies still pose a threat. And so the NFL thing and how pleased they were with it, and the fact that 13 million people watched, and the fact that according to them, they signed up so many new subscribers, to me, that says that we are going to see, like, the media aspect of what they're doing is going to continue to grow more aggressive. And I think we're going to see more bids in the world of sports rights. I think we're going to see other big budget tentpole series beyond Lord of the Rings, provided those metrics are working out in the same way for them. I don't know. I feel like, not to, this is a little too obvious, but I do feel like it's day one for Amazon in terms of their entry into you know, the media and entertainment space.
The Walmart note is interesting. I mean, I think that if you're listening to the powers that be, if you read me and Dylan, I mean, like, you are a college educated elite, perhaps living in a blue bubble somewhere. we like, our own media diets are not the rest of the country's media diets. Yeah. Our consumer habits are not the rest of the country's. And the Walmart thing made me think of a recent conversation I had with someone at Roku. And I feel this working at Snapchat too, to be honest. Like, elites use Twitter, you know, non-elites like use Snapchat. Uh-huh. Like, we have more people by a factor of like two, like twice as many people are using Snap as Twitter. That's my personal rant, which you've heard a million times. But like, the guy from Roku was sort of saying that they've got like 60 million users in the US. It's like the number one streaming hardware platform, whatever. And like, a lot of people in the room are like, what?
Right.
Really?
Right.
He's like, yeah, like most people are using this platform. They're not like logging in via their Samsung smart TV that's really expensive.
Yeah.
You know, they're buying this add-on and that's how they're accessing content. And it's just funny that, you know, Amazon is smart to think of Walmart as a rival in that sense, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Again, this myopia. It's like, we have all the data at our disposal to see how consumers behave. And yet, in the New York Times, I would hazard a guess that, like, for every article about Yellowstone, far and away the most watched drama, there have been 10 articles about Succession, which really, like, nobody yeah, exactly. is watching outside of, you know, like, you and me and our friends. It's just sort of an enduring quality about how we think about the world, and it's really hard to break out of that.
Yes. Your screen is not someone else's screen.
That's right.
Always remember that. All right, Dylan. Thank you so much. We will try not to steal your reporting on Monday, but no promises.
It's all yours.
When we come back, Ben Landy talks to Julia Alexander about horror movies.
Imagine sleeping in the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's iconic sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code Odyssey. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify is got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
Welcome back to The Powers That Be. I'm Ben Landy, here with streaming analyst Julia Alexander to talk about one of my favorite questions, what everyone should be watching and why the correct genre is horror.
I love that. This is the only question, I think, in my opinion. It's the only one that matters.
Julia, you wrote a piece for Puck last night that, first of all, was a total joy to edit, but also really fascinating to me because it confirmed a hunch that I've had for a while, which is that scary movies, slashers, horror franchises, all that good stuff are actually some of the best and most reliable moneymakers for both theaters and streaming at a time when both of those things are under some pressure. What was some of the data that you are seeing in your industry?
To preface it, it's not revolutionary to say that horror tends to, especially if it's really good horror, tends to perform well on the budget that it's made on. Horror tends to be much cheaper to produce. It's why we get so many of like insert name 10 here, right? Like it's just a cheaper movie to make. And so people are kind of willing to say, well, this might be our next breakout hit. This could be the next Saw. This could be the next Insidious. So we're going to a Paranormal Activity. Like we're going to throw money at it and see what happens. What's really interesting over the last few years, though, is that as theaters and as companies that have a theatrical business are trying to discover what type of films are more likely to get people back into theaters, while at the same time, many of these companies are also running owned and operated streaming services, they're really having this conversation, the overarching anxiety about how to distribute content to make the strongest return on investment. So if we just look at some of the data points over the last few years, like this year alone, of the top, I believe it was 25 movies, three of the highest grossing are horror movies. They're hitting kind of above their average, all of them coming in at about $140 million minimum from a box office. That includes movies like The Black Phone, which came from Blumhouse, which, you know, really was a shocker to a lot of people. So you've got a lot of stuff happening in theaters. And of course, Jordan Peele's Nope did exceptionally well. But on streaming, you also have movies like Prey, which was, you know, I believe there was a Nielsen stat that when that movie came out within this first 3 days, it landed as the fourth most watched show, according to Nielsen, in the United States, which is a big deal for Hulu. That doesn't really happen for Hulu. We also have from the company saying specifically that that movie was one of the most watched titles of all time on Hulu, brought in an entirely new audience of people that they were really excited about, which translates to new subscribers. And so there's this moment happening where as anxiety kind of looms large over the industry, horror has kind of become this consistent, strong heartbeat. To say that, you know, that is not necessarily saying this is ever going to replace Marvel films, but when people are kind of looking for something to really rely on, horror is once again emerging as this thing to point to.
The Prey movie was incredible. I watched that on Hulu and loved it, but I totally would have paid money to see it in theaters.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. When we think about what works theatrically, like what I tell my clients about is there's certain criteria that needs to be met. One, does this feel like something that should be experienced in a communal setting? Does this feel like something I need people around me to watch? Two, is this going to take advantage of technology that I don't have at home? So that could be incredible sound systems, that could be a huge screen, whatever it might be. And three, does this feel like something I need to see immediately to avoid spoilers or to be part of the cultural zeitgeist conversation? If we take those things into account, there are a few genres that really perform well in theaters, the biggest one, of course, being action, because it takes advantage of all three of those. On the other side of things, you know, where do we see genres that are really floundering because of these rules? Well, that's comedy and dramas to an extent, like independent dramas, where people are saying, actually, I can watch that on Netflix or Hulu or HBO Max as part of my subscription, and I feel like I'm getting the value that I perceived I would get out of it. Horror, if we think about movies like A Quiet Place, if we think about movies like The Black Phone, if we think about movies like the recently released Barbarian film, which is actually has a really strong kind of week over week. It's sitting at about 29% drop, which is really, really strong. To put that into comparison, Thor Love and Thunder had like a 70% drop in its second week. You know, in its third week, Barbarian sitting at 29%. If we think about what those movies do, one, horror is always the type of film that is experienced best in a communal setting because people react in time. They yell, they jump, they laugh, they yell things. It's this thing that happens. Two, if I think of Quiet Place, for example, that movie is reliant on really strong audio technology in a theater to really make those moments as truly terrifying as they can be. And also, because you're in a theater, I live in Brooklyn, I get fire trucks by my apartment all the time. I just live on a busy road. That really takes away from the ambiance of a film that you get in a theater. And three, again, if you take a movie like Barbarian, there's some wild twists in there. And of course, no spoilers, but that's something that in the first 2 weeks it was out, it became the only movie that my friends were saying, we have to go watch this film because I just keep hearing wild things. So if you look at those three requirements for potentially having a film that does well, not always, but potentially, horror really kind of hits that a consistent amount of times.
I mean, if there's one thing that has not changed about horror, it's that the upfront costs for producing not all of these movies, and certainly not all the television shows, but many of the movies can be pretty low. So, you know, you look at one of my favorite horror movies the last couple of years, The Witch, that cost like $3 or $4 million to make. And then it went on to do like 10x that at the box office. It's interesting to me that with those economics, you can actually afford to take a lot of swings at bat. So it's sort of the flip side of the typical mood in Hollywood that tends these days to be very conservative and risk averse. There are definitely weird horror movies out there, and not all of them are going to do okay, but that's fine because they cost so little to make and you only need a few of them to massively overperform. I mean, it's sort of like the venture capital model of investing in startups. You really need 1 out of 10 hits to make a fabulous amount of money on them.
Yeah. And I think you just touched on something extremely important. If we look at what a lot of analysts will sometimes, you know, if they're asked this question about what they would kind of recommend for a company like a Netflix, you know, Netflix, it's really hard to make a bunch of money off a $200 million action movie if it doesn't do exactly what you need it to do. It's a risk. And for a company like Netflix, you take those risks because you're building a brand and because you want to be able to compete and because you want to be able to be in that space. But what pays the bills, right, are kind of the holiday movies that we think of, the Hallmark style movies and horror films, you know, and I would be someone who would recommend for Netflix to even kind of push into that a little bit more because horror finds different audiences. Certain films might find a young female audience. Certain films might find an older male audience. And so you can really widen your demographics. Horror, because its very nature is to kind of shock and its very nature is to kind of be this compelling, fun thing to watch with your friends, really has this advantage of potentially creating a cultural zeitgeisty moment. Also, horror appeals to different taste clusters because you have the ability to take all these chances with horror, in part because the production budget is not as steep for the most part, and because you can really take chances with it. There's this advantage that horror has to really travel further, both on streaming and potentially theatrically.
Yeah, I'm totally the target demographic for that because I will put on just about any horror movie on streaming. I'm not going to take a chance on some low-budget indie movie, but if I see a 90-minute scary movie on Shudder, on AMC+, I will totally watch it. And frankly, I've exhausted almost all the ones in the catalog. So last question for you. Do you have any recommendations, favorite horror movie of 2022 that I haven't seen?
Ooh, the one that I've seen this year that really kind of always comes back to me is Nope. I had some friends over last night and a bunch of them had never seen Scream, like the original. And so we watched Scream and then I rewatched Scream 5, which came out in January. And that movie is still one of my favorite movies of the year. I will say I'm most excited about Pearl, which I'm planning to see this week, which is a follow-up to Ty West's X, which came out a few months ago. They're kind of doing the like Fast and Succession style horror movies the way that Netflix did with Fear Street. That really worked for Netflix. So I think all of those, and then the one I always recommend people, because it's on HBO Max, if you have HBO Max, it's already there, is Malignant, which takes you on a wild ride and was truly incredible. And that's kind of my go-to every year. Now, well, for the last 2 years now, that's been my go-to that I tell people about.
So good. I haven't watched X yet, but let me know how Pearl is. And I'll be right behind you in the theaters.
Definitely.
Thanks, Julia. Appreciate you coming by.
Thanks, Ben.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of The Powers That Be. As a reminder, The Powers That Be is the official podcast of Puck. We'd like to thank Ben Landy, Liz Goff, and Alex Bigler for their editorial and production guidance. If you like what you hear, please share with a friend. It really helps us keep delivering the inside scoop that only Puck can offer. Follow us on Twitter at Puck News. I'm Peter Hamby. See you tomorrow. This has been a presentation of Cadence 13 Studios. Please listen, rate, review, and follow all episodes wherever you get your podcasts. The Powers That Be Daily is executive produced by John Kelly, co-founder of Puck, and Chris Corcoran, chief content officer and founding partner of Cadence 13.